Hello, welcome to Holman Village. Today is Monday, June 29th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is Walter Wangren Jr. Today's session number is 98-1, and it's titled Spirituality and Story, Hospitality Part 1, Spiritual Source. Let's listen in.
We fill up the whole time. Should I close that door? He'll close it. He'll close it. That doesn't mean to keep people out, but just for sounds. And it's okay. Pardon? Some will come late. I know that. Yeah. And some of them have to come late. That's okay. So I'm going to do something at the beginning that has nothing to do with anything else. You can start rolling the tape. Should we leave that door open for a while, do you think, then?
It's okay.
They'll walk in. My name is Walt Wangren. I forgot, am I supposed to say what my topic is? Well, it's hospitality, but it'll slur into art, and it'll slur into storytelling, and they asked for a main title, so I put spirituality down in story, because I think it falls under that as well. But I will use hospitality as a kind of a springboard for certain thoughts. Throughout this week, I will use hospitality that way. I should tell you that I do not assume that what I'm going to give you is in any way complete or completely comprehensive. I've broken it down into five elements, as you see, and I'm going to touch each element, four of them. We only have 4 days, so I'll touch four of those elements and speak around and to them a little bit. Do some teaching underneath that, some Bible teaching. But my habit has become to speak indirectly about things by the telling of stories. I often want, when I see people say storyteller and storytelling, I want to say to the grown-up Lutherans, it's okay, this is not just for children. That there is sometimes as much communicated by the telling of a story, if not more, from generation to generation, than by discursive learning. We Protestants just sort of generally tend. I knew as I grew up, they told me stories in Sunday school. When I hit seminary, they ceased all that. They ceased it in college. It became discursive learning. And so I always had the sense that when you pass from story into propositional teaching, that you pass from childhood into adulthood. Well, I'd like to call you into further adulthood. We are a peculiar people this way. Almost all cultures in the past communicated the ineffable complexities of who they were, not by breaking them down into analytic parts, but by telling stories. And indeed, our scripture, which contains teachings and wisdoms and psalms and various kinds of direct theologies, thinking about God, thinking about ways to think about God, thinking about ways to relate to God, is fundamentally a story. So I will use story. And I will assume that you know that although story carries you, and you begin to get a sense of a certain passivity, I mean, that's fine. You will feel a tad passive. That nevertheless, as you, with all of your intelligence and your experience, experience a story, you will, in time, begin to understand more and more, consciously or unconsciously, about what a story brings you. I'll say much more about story on Wednesday when I get to talk on these five elements of the act of hospitality. If you don't mind, once before I was at Holden, every once in a while when I've done a manuscript, this is the best place for me to test things. It really is. It's a gathering of intelligent people who allow their intelligence a certain kind of freedom. If the intelligence is in any way bridled or halted, it requires a certain kind of talk. I thought I will read you. I just finished, actually, 2 weeks ago, a draft of a manuscript on Christmas. It's called Christmas Collection. And I thought I would begin each session just with one of the carols that I've written for this. Various kinds of carols. Here's the very last one. In the third section of this book, I ruminated on gold and frankincense and myrrh. And so I'll begin with this, and then I'll begin our session. This is a blessing to me as much as to you. I don't know how it will be to you. One day this will find some music, I think. It's just called Gold. Molten gold is the godly sun, and the Son of God my golden one. Gold for him, the first of three, is what the boy became for me. Gold he grew and golden spoke, confounding scholars of the book.
Gold he walked and golden was, in blazing envy and black lust. And greed loves gold, but greed despised the sunny judgment of his eyes. Gold he lived and golden died when pride accomplished regicide. My golden prince went underground to tear the gates of Satan down. And rose this morning, he the light, and I the fleeing of the night. Golden eyes and golden brow, he is the king of heaven now, and he shall beam at heaven's gate, his Walter to illuminate. One day I'll walk his golden town in shoes of silk and silver gowns. Molten gold is the godly sun, and the Son of God my golden one. Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to begin with a story. I'm going to allow this story to be kind of an embracing of the elements that I'll refer to. Today is a bit of an introduction to these, and then I'm going to speak a bit about motive and source and attitude to the business of hospitality. I'll get to a bit of an explanation of hospitality after this story. This story may seem to you, on first blush, not necessarily a referent to hospitality as we conceive it, but I think it is. Particularly as we, in this age, allow the spirituality of hospitality to expand in our minds. I suspect that you know that the history of hospitality throughout all ages is this necessary saving of life, that hospitality in the Middle East was a way in which those who were famished or dying or hungry or between places would receive food and drink and shade and rest. And the effect of this sort of thing was literally to save lives. That's why hospitality, among other reasons, was so crucial. Some of you may even remember or have heard stories from your parents and your grandparents when the plains or the prairies were just being farmed and people would come through, various kinds of salespersons would come through and simply knock on a door. My mother-in-law remembers this in Minnesota. And very few questions were asked, but it was the nature of the thing to take that person in, feed that person, and give them a bed, and let them sleep. And on their way, they went the next morning, and it was assumed. And that's part of because nature was a difficult thing. Nature could kill you. And so from place to place, this act of hospitality was an act of, as it were, spreading community, even if you never saw that person again. It was a sense of the necessity of human beings for human beings to save one another when they were in desperate straits or before they might become desperate. What's happened in our country now is that we have such transportation modes, we have such communication modes that people can call ahead, you know, and they can be sure that they don't have to knock on doors anymore. But I begin to realize, nevertheless, that if our geography is not always that which makes us strangers and in danger, certainly our society is. Certainly our society is. And so I spiritualize a little bit some of the concepts of hospitality, that we need these places of, let me use this word, refuge. We need these places of sanctuary. Think of the community that you're in. I'm talking to all communities to be hospitable, sanctuary as the sanctuary of a church. We need these places of asylum. I'm a little sorry some of these most beautiful words like asylum have been depressed in their meanings. We put people we don't want with us in asylums now. Insane asylums and so forth. Whereas it always meant those people that no one else wanted were those we would take in. So my story. I have a friend. I still have him as a friend. His first name is Mel. Melvin. He was a classmate of mine in Concordia, Milwaukee. When we went, now Fred wasn't in Concordia, Milwaukee, but he was in a Concordia, and so he knows that sequence of things where you're sent away from home at the natal age of 13. Sometimes you didn't have a choice. I was the oldest of the family, and I really didn't have a choice, and I was terribly homesick, so much. But Melvin and I became friends, and he came from a farm up in Mequon, Wisconsin, a little bit farther north, and in those days, north of Mequon, Freistadt, actually, was all farming land, and his parents owned a dairy farm. His mother raised vegetables for sort of truck farming, and how they added money to their income. And I would go with Melvin during those years, high school and 2 years college. I'd go with him to his farm. I would, the first time I ever saw a calf born. Oh, I wish I had time. That to me was just elemental, that calf coming out. It was his father with those thick fingers. It was his father that actually helped drag that calf out. And after the calf came a balloon of water. I don't know what I'm talking about, but the sun was shining. This has nothing to do with my story. I'm sorry. But it's so moving. It was a balloon of water. It's all I can say about it. It came out afterward and attached to the calf itself. And the sun was shining. The morning sun was shining so that it was like a globe of light. It had caught the light so that it became a globe of light, like a vase that holds light and shines it out. And what I saw him do with that thumb was just punctured. Boom. Went on the ground. And there was that calf striving to stand right away. I saw that when I was in high school. And then I used to work for his mother, who would bring the vegetables into town to the farmer's market. She was short, she was tough, she was good-hearted and good-spirited, and I didn't know German as well, of course, as she did, and all these people used to come to buy Kartoffeln and the potatoes and so forth and so on, and they would try to argue with me. And of course, they knew they could. And mostly it was the women of the households who would come and they'd poke these little potatoes and then they'd say, how much? And I would say, and they'd say, no. So they would argue with me until Melvin's mother would come up, and she just dazzled me because she could talk really fast in German to them, and by the time she had sold them at her price, the potatoes, they felt grateful. And she used to cook on the farm, and they had a lane they called Real Lane. And they called it Real Lane because when they first got the farm, the trees were already there. The trees were like canopy, which went out to what I always called a meadow. They called it pasture. I always called it a meadow out there. I loved going to that place, and I loved Melvin. Melvin did not go on to the senior college. Certain things began to happen on the farm that kept him from continuing his education. And even now, he still lives on the farm. He's never left it. He lives there with his mother. It's just Melvin and his mother. And they had to sell off acres of the farm. They had to sell it in 5-acre lots, actually, because that was it was getting to be a rich place. And rich people define how much you can sell and so forth and so on. It's hard, very defined. And Melvin hung on because they continued to sell after his father died, and then it was only his mother and he, and I would visit every once in a while when I was in the Milwaukee area. Some time ago, I went to visit him in the fall and knocked on the door. Beautiful fall day, the sky high blue and scrubbed. And you know, and the smell in the air, they've only got 5 acres left. But on their 5 acres, they have some old orchard trees. The apples fall and they get pierced, as you know, and they begin to put a sort of cider smell in the air, which I just love. It makes the saliva come out of my mouth. I knocked on the door and Melvin answered it, and when he opened it up, I smelt cinnamon and I smelt like apple pie. Just think on all this stuff. This is welcoming. I mean, you can welcome with smells as well as with a handshake. I smelled apple pie, and that house is just immaculate. I said, Melvin, and then after we had greeted each other, I said, your mother baked pie. And his face fell, and he said, no. No, he said, I see to the necessary things now. That's a quote. He said, I see to the necessary things. Melvin is lean, even to this day. He's very quiet. He's red all of his life. He wears half glasses, as I do. And he sits in what they call the parlor. They still call the parlor of that. He sits in the parlor and he reads at night. He's got a chair and he's got a lamp that comes over his right shoulder. It's very dim so that the room itself can be dark. But he'll read in there until 2, 3, or 4 a.m. because that's where his mother sleeps. And he needs to be there for her. He invited me into the house and we went through. There's a hallway and to the right would be the kitchen. And then the dining room is immediately attached around, but to the left, through a door, and then the staircase goes up like this, is the parlor. And he invited me into the parlor itself. And there was his mother sitting up in bed. The bed was against the far wall, and it was possible to put pillows up behind her, and so they were all up behind her like that, and she was sitting up. And then Melvin did something that just absolutely surprised me. He introduced me to his mother, whom I had known and who had been like a mother to me all along. And he did it most formally. Melvin, whose intelligence honestly could benefit governors and presidents and bishops if they would listen to people like him. He walked to his mother and he took her hand like this and looked her in the eye and said, Mother, be pleased to meet, and he named me for Walter Hornbridge, as if we'd never met before. And when he did that, you go boom, boom, boom through feelings. Boom, why is he doing that? Boom, what's the matter? Boom, ah, I know. She raised her eyes only this far to me. Watery blue eyes, moist watery blue eyes. Her face was broad and soft. It was like a plate with no expression in it whatsoever, except she had a smile. She just always kept a smile. She has beautiful teeth. smile, but her eyes only came up this far. And Melvin handed her hand to me, and I reached and I took her hand, and it was just as soft as putty. There was no strength or no trying even to shake my hand back again. And her skin was as white as flour, altogether white as flour. And then I knew why I was being introduced. She had no idea who I was. She had no idea. She scarcely even said a word. She looked me this high, and I didn't know why her eyes were here. This is where she was looking with her watery eyes. This dear woman, who had spoken faster than anybody else in German and in English as well, and who cooked so well, who was so hospitable, didn't know where she was. And Melvin saw that she was looking at me right here, and so he went to the sideboard and he got a bunch of prunes without pits and gave her the prunes, and then she was really happy, and she just has this wonderful set of teeth, so she was chewing those prunes as we walked out the door and outside. Melvin and I walked, and that's how I could see the size of the farm down to 5 acres. He kept some trees in order to try to keep some privacy. He grows a garden out there as well. And in the fall, you know, the garden has the melons still in it. There's some broccoli that's still trying to crown and so forth. Melons, and he's got squashes and so forth. And we walked and we talked, and I was his guest and he was my host. And that evening we ate supper together, and he fed me his apple pie, which is as welcoming as anything I know. I mean, I'm sorry that it's been abused as America. There's something blessed about a good apple pie. And we sat up a little bit. We drank a little wine. I went to bed. He sat in his chair. I went to sleep. I was on the second floor. Somewhere in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock a.m., I started hearing downstairs just a horrible howling. And it woke me up with a rush. It was like, yeah, na, 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 na. Complaint, yowling, I didn't know what it was. And I snapped up, and I came down the stairs. I came down the stairs into the kitchen, even in the dim light. And then I saw that there was just a low light in the parlor, and that's where the crying was coming from. Yeah, na, 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 in the parlor. And so I went to the parlor door itself, and I got a bit of the ways into the parlor, and I saw Mel, and he was kneeling beside his mother, and I almost backed out, but he turned around and he saw me, and he smiled, and he nodded to the chair that I should sit, and it was his mother. Her head was thrown back, and she was at the top of her lungs going, yeah, na, 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 just so loud. I mean, there was no restraint on that whatsoever. Melvin was literally kneeling beside her. I sat down in his chair where the dim light was on, and I watched, and I smelled, and I realized what Melvin was doing. He was changing her diapers. He was changing her diapers, his mother's diapers. He was cleaning her. He was making her clean. And as time went on, I began to realize one other thing that was in the room. And that was the sound. Melvin was singing. He was not only changing his mother's diapers and cleaning her, he was also singing. Softly, and I could hear the words and I recognized them, because in truth, I tell you these words my mother sang to me. Müde bin ich, geh zur Ruhe. Vater macht die Augen zu. And you could go on and on. He was singing to her. And do you know what she was doing? She was singing with him. That's what that sound was at the top of her lungs. She was, yeah, na, 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 na. She was singing with our son. And I have no doubt that by his song and her voice, she was young again, and she was wearing yellow dresses, and she was running in the green grass, and she was beautiful. She was as beautiful as she was at Sunday school, as beautiful as when her mother sang that song to her as a child. In her mind, all was well. All was well. And every manner of thing was well, because that stranger was given a home by the blessed honoring of her son, Melvin. To me, that's a picture of hospitality. In spiritual ways, as well as in more discursive ways. I'd like to stop for a minute and just think on just think about what Melvin is doing there. Well, those of you who are from the farm, aren't there still yet those bachelor farmers who stayed there because of their parents, or some of the women who stayed because of their parents? And saw that as a necessary. You know, Melvin never complains about that. He came to the school that made ministers, and then he went on and became one. became a minister. He is one. I watched him minister. I watched him kneeling down and ministering. And granting unto his mother, the stranger, a hospitable place and an identity and talk and service. See, those are the things that I see. When I think of hospitality, I find five elements in it. I find that there is a motive, there is a source, there is a reason we do what we do. But there's the creation of some kind of a holy, practical, maybe not holy, but a practical, protected space. And I mean that both physically and spiritually. There is a space to which we, into which we invite people, which I'll talk about tomorrow. And so he did, you know. He created that space physically. You notice that he was the host for two, for me and for his mother both. And I really think it was a blessing that he invited me in to sit down in that chair, because he invited me into a sanctum. He invited me into a holy place that I don't think I would have, except that he was also inviting me to enjoy my friendship with him. So that space was for his mother, and it was also for me. And again and again, one element of hospitality is the feeding of others. From the beginning, covenant meals. We moved to Grand Forks, North Dakota when I was a child. I was in the second grade. My father was a pastor at Grand Forks, North Dakota Emanuel Church. We came up from Chicago. Before that, we'd been out in the West, so I never had met this thing before, Norwegian. Scandinavia. And they invited us over, you know, and I knew that they were giving us covenant meals. Lefse. Well, it had to do with the covenant, you know. It had to do with, this is my culture, what's your culture? Come and eat with my culture. Learn a little bit about me. Now, my parents and grandparents and so forth, it was roast beef and potatoes, and this is the declaration of covenantal love. You ate what they put before you. And just to prove that this covenant was tight and you were obedient, they put three helpings. Oh, I fill my little belly up. And on by would come my grandma. Well, had enough?
Yes, yes.
No, you haven't. Because as I ate that food, I was honoring the covenant, you know. I was saying, yes, you're my grandma. Oh, do I love you. Covenantal meal. Covenantal meal. The 70 elders and Moses and Aaron on the mountain, and God feeds them. And talk. Always talk. And I will do this on Wednesday in the service, as he was doing to his mother, you see. All those things. If you don't mind, one of the ways in which I research things, I taught history of the English language in my first university. It was bequeathed me. Some of you who maybe know English know that not everyone jumps to teach the history of the English language, particularly football players, who are there on a scholarship, and the best thing they can get into is something like education. And they're required in those days. I don't know what it is now to take history. For me, it was a wonderful thing. Philology became something that I had great affection for. And I find that some of the best ways to see the development of something, some practice or some thought or philosophy among peoples, is to watch where the words go, to go backward to the words. You can understand, one of the best ways to understand the earliest cultures that we know that were linguistic, you can go back to the Indo-European and previous to the Sanskrit and find out what they drank there by what word has spread into all the languages that developed from there. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? Yeah, so you start with a primitive language, and as time goes on, it spreads, just like at the Tower of Babel, except that it builds as people go off. And the words that are cognates in all of these disassociated language means they existed in the motherest of tongues. They're there. So, for example, we know that one of the best drinks they ever had from the very beginning was alcoholic. Sorry, but it was. It was an alcoholic beverage made from honey. Melissa, whose name is Melissa. She has a very old name, and she remembers in her very name the drink that they used to have. It became mead, yeah. Sure, it made everyone hospitable. So I do that here. This is the biblical language. This is Latin. But Latin reveals to us the development of the Christian church in the early days and beyond. And so I did a little bit of searching in Latin. As I understand, Fred, I don't think there's a Hebrew word specifically for hospitality. But it's a very variety of concepts, and it's a very deep one. But there is a Greek word, which is philoxenia, which literally means philos, love, xenia, stranger, foreigner, the love of the foreigner. It means loving the foreigner. And right away you begin to get an idea of how they perceived hospitality. The stranger, the foreigner. There's a different set of rules and necessary ones that have to do with the immediate community. But there's also a set of rules on how you deal with the sojourner and the foreigner, the one who is otherwise seen as the different one, the other. Alien in Latin, you know, simply means the other one. Because we're so scared of the other one, we start putting our fears in those words that meant nothing but the other, and now alien means to us people that we want to get out of the country, or the alien that scares us or what have you. Those things were added later on because of what we always thought of the other. That's why hospitality was so crucial, because it was something that had to be trained into them. When the other comes, there is a set of ways to respond to the other. And the other, this means both foreigner and stranger, it embraces them both, this xenia. In fact, xenos itself literally means all three of these, foreigner, stranger, and yes, even the enemy. I'm speaking both now biblically, but also in classical Greek. It embraces all three of those. And then when it becomes a practice, this I find to be especially revealing to me, but I'm not sure all of what it reveals. That same word xenos means both host and guest. It means them both. It means both host and guest. So it embraces them in a kind of unity, if not community. The act of hospitality is the establishment of relationship where the rules and the roles blur. Something is happening in hospitality, even if the sojourner goes on thereafter. This is like the seeds of community, host and guest. It also, dear people, I need to underline, this host is not just an individual, though it may be. It may be a household becomes the host. The whole household enacts this kindness to strangers with all of its variety of roles. I think of Holden Village as a household or a community, which gets very serious about this blur between host and guest. It begins, and if you will, I think almost as a sequence, and I'll get that with a Latin word, that is to say, the practice of hospitality turns the stranger into a guest, and that's where this begins to blur. There's a sort of dramatic progression. If you remember the xenos word, it turns the enemy and stranger into, or a foreigner, into a guest. There's a process that takes place. It isn't just a static command. It's something that literally affects what's going on in a relationship. A community which is hospitable and embraces the enemy, stranger, foreigner as a guest, and then ultimately, potentially, as a member, that community lives in that activity. It declares itself in that activity. It witnesses to what it is in that activity. It is what it is publicly and manifest in that activity. And if you're taking notes, I'm sorry, I can't repeat all that. But you get the idea. It is a manifestation of the character of the place as it serves. Anyway, remarkably, as often is the case between Greek and Latin, even though the words are not necessarily cognates, you find that they have almost exactly the same meaning. And it's not just because the Greeks and the Romans did an awful lot of interaction, which certainly they did. It's because they came from some of the same concepts, even if we think differently. Hospes. Hospes is like xenos. You see, it's not a cognate. It's not an oral cognate. But it does have the same meaning. It means stranger and guest and host. It means, so there's almost a literal association here. But then comes all of our words, and I want to show you what happens with them. Once again, this word means all of these. It means host, it means guest, it means stranger, and therefore it declares a kind of conjoining that takes place in this act, where the rules and the roles begin to blur, which leads to the potential of membership. You don't strive for membership, those of you who are churches. You don't strive to make them members. It happens because you are hospitable. And there becomes the potential that they may find ways to associate themselves with you, which is more than stranger guest. I like this language. I know that even as a pastor, I would always say, well, the visitors among us arise. But I think I like this word guest better because of the potential around it. And guest means something that I do, whereas visitor often means something that they do. The visitor chooses to come and visit us. It's their act, and we respond. Whereas the word guest, especially with these ancient meanings, is somehow how we reach to them and effectively present unto them blessings and goodness so that the stranger becomes our guest and the guest potentially may become our member. Now, hospitem is the accusative of hospes. That's all it is. But as it gets to be used, you'll notice the concept, the act, as well as the atmosphere, becomes our word hospitality. It really comes from the accusative of this word. It will be involved in what goes on here. These two words, hospitem and hospitem, are almost interchangeable in certain periods of the early Christian Latin. Hospitem, the accusative hospes, stranger, guest, host. In hospitem, includes the P-O-T. It's a variation of the P-O-T in here, the P-I-T. Potens means mastery or power. So what are we coming to now? We're saying that there is a practice here which is so well known and so crucial and important that some people become potens at it. They become mistresses and masters of it. Do you follow what I'm saying? So then this word becomes contracted into this word. But this is what creeps behind it. The master or the mistress of hospitality, of meeting strangers and letting them become guests. Boy, I can't say that enough. Letting them become guests by the service of food and conversation and the space that they give. We're identified. So it becomes a mastery of hosting, which then splits into two different words in our English language. We don't use this word much, but it's there. Hospitium. Hospitium is a hospice. Now, I know exactly what you're thinking of hospice, and that's good. It's telling me, and I'll come to it in a minute, it's telling me that all I'm telling you is still a living thing. It's still growing. It's still changing. But hospice in the old English meant simply a place where people could find shelter. Specifically, a hospice was usually at, in Jerusalem they had one, at... Okay, here's where I'm going to make sure you're all listening, because I need the help here. What is Lourdes? What do you call that? Where do pilgrims go?
Shrines.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there another word for that? Shrines? Well, there probably is. Where pilgrims go to get, what, healed? Where pilgrims go to worship? A hospice was something that grew up at the shrines. We know it existed in Jerusalem even before the 10th century. And it was called hospice, and then it became hospital. Hospice became that place where the tired and the weary pilgrim could find shelter and rest. It's a little bit like when you traveled Europe when you were a kid and you stayed at the youth hostels. But there was a place for it. And they would welcome people in, and not always would they feed them, but they would certainly make sure that they could sleep in a protected place. Now look what has happened to our word hospice today, huh? Isn't that wonderful? It's developed into an activity that sits down with the dying. So that hospice now becomes a way in which we meet those who are like Melvin's mother, who are the strangers in this land, but we do it in such a way that they're not strangers anymore in their own house. We hope to do it in their houses. And we bring their whole family in. I'm sure you know, that definition of this word is exceedingly recent. It's exceedingly recent. So it's still living. Hospitium, hardly used. Hospice, used much. But you need to understand something else. And this is a development of the Christian church. It's not in the, it's in the New Testament indirectly, and I'll tell you how in just a minute. And that is that the actual healing of people. These hospices, or these hospitem, these places where people were well received, these inns, were not for the rich. They were for the poor. They were for the ones who came without slaves to take care of them, without money to buy a place in the inn. They were the ones who came destitute, but who came to worship. What happened as time went on is they also came sick, especially to the shrines, to the places where they might look for healing. They came sick. They came exhausted, they came without clothes, they came without shoes, and these places, which now began to be called hospitals, were where people gathered to heal as well. So out of hospitality comes this whole concept that not only is the stranger taken in, but the stranger is also healed. So our word hospital springs from hospitality. Think of what all that means. I mentioned this in passing, but actually in our own history, historically, we didn't really have hospitals until mid-19th century. What we had was physicians for the rich, especially in Europe and England and so forth and so on. It was a little bit of a different development here in the United States or in America, whatever you want to call it. The rich people had physicians come to their houses. That was the practice. Or else they were attached to the house. They were attached to the lord and lady. That's where they did their business. It's simply like the rich people also had their own priests, you know. Got your own priest, got your own doctor. Where were the poor to go? I mean, who's going to come to the poor? Nobody. Where the poor ended up going was to places like these shrines. And at places like those shrines, there were people who were willing to be physicians unto them. Thus grew the concept of the sick going somewhere, rather than the physician coming to the sick. Thus grew the concept of hospitals. And it really developed from this whole business of the pilgrims, who were people passing through to worship, who were people in need. It developed out of hospitality. That's why, you know, as I work through here, I often think that charity and hospitality are sisters. They are siblings somehow. And when you think of charity, where does it fetch up underneath the various disciplines that we talk about within the Christian tradition? It often fetches up underneath the concept of hospitality, because that's where charity took place. That's where healing and feeding, in the sense of what we do for the poor. See? So there's an association, and that does go back to the Old Testament. God is very explicit about how we should handle or deal with the poor themselves. Let me see, there was one other thought that I wanted to give you about this sequence. Okay, it has slipped my mind. Let me give you these thoughts. What would destroy our capacity to be hospitable? I'm going to give you two answers, and then I'd just like you to go on and think about it, because I think there are several things that just destroy our capacity to be hosts. Who serve, who give place, who give food, to do a sweet thing. I think of two immediately that I see around me a lot, and one of these I confess I'm guilty of. The one is fear of the other, fear. And the other is arrogance, a presumption that the highest moral standard to which I may adhere is individual rights and my own liberties. That the law and morality in this land and in this spiritual community is really meant to protect me. Now, there's a way of going after individual rights which doesn't do this, obviously. There are ways to do it where we are conscious of other people whose rights have been taken away. And that's liberation. That's liberation. But an awful lot of the talk that I hear in various forms, some of it highly intelligent and some of it just burping, in this country right now is that people argue for their personal and individual rights. That sense that I am somehow at the center of my existence will obviate for me any sense that I need to serve somebody else. And if I do serve that other person, it will not be with the right attitude. So that's where we're getting now with attitude. At least those two. I'm sure you can think of other things too. The second, there are two things I think that allow us still to be hospitable, but perhaps not to allow the Spirit of Christ to show in our hospitality. So I'm at a different level now. I can think of two things by which we would be hospitable, but the Spirit of Christ wouldn't be there. Yes, we would feed. Yes, we would give room. Yes, we would give talk and place and so forth and so on. And one, I think, is the sense of noblesse oblige. And dear people, I've run into this so much, I would love to talk about it a lot. This is often our congregational sin. By noblesse oblige, what I mean is, we have this sense, I have this sense, that I've done well, I've earned my living, and I've earned it even to excess. I'm intelligent, I have a good deal of talents, which I could share with other people. So in order to serve God, what I'm going to do is to go to those poor people who are not doing well, who certainly haven't come to the elevation of knowledge and understanding and talent and success that I have, and I'm going to help them. It's like this. I'm going to help you. And then notice this, that she reaches up, and I'm bowing down to her level to help her. Well, you know, many of you may know that I was pastor in an inner city congregation for years and years. We started a social ministry when we were there, and it became my job to fundraise, to raise money. And I'm a good speaker, you know, so I would go and speak to these congregations, often Lutheran congregations. And I would persuade them, yes, to give some money to the Mission of Grace, which, you know, served the poor. I mean, the really poor. But this is how they would give. I don't have a dollar. But they would give something like this. Pretend this is a dollar.
Here you go. Hold on. Like this, that's how I give.
No, hold on. Let me give it to you. But I'm going to hold on to this end because I want to be sure how you're going to use it. So now, are you going to get an education with this or are you just going to drink it up? This is what I ran into again and again. They would say, yes, well, we will help that. But now how are they going to use it? What are you going to use it for? And I would have to go bend over backward, A, to figure out what sort of standards they were not saying, but according to which they're going to give or not give, and B, to look like I'm going to do those standards. And I began to be jealous for the poor. I began to be jealous for them. Because I realize, or at least I realized then, and I think the laws of gleaning in the Old Testament, such things like that, suggest that what is excess unto God, who is the one who owns all things and distributes them, it isn't something that I give to the poor to control the poor. And dear people, I know works righteousness, I know the works ethic is very important to how we have resolved a lot of problems in our society. We are a can-do people. I know that that's important. I want to praise it. But I will say there's just the taint of a cultural bias in the work ethic. And there are people from other cultures for whom that particular standard is not necessarily holy. And even God wouldn't say it's holy for them. I hope you're following me. And so when I would talk to these people, they felt that they were just being very righteous, trying to get the work ethic in there. They want to be sure that their money is going to help these people, but they have a notion of what help means, and so they hang on to it. I can't give it. I mean, we got to know he's not going to drink it up. That's what I heard a lot. How do you know they're not going to? And I would often say, I don't know. But I know that I am called to serve those people who require community for a living. I'm called to leave a little bit of grain on the ground and to go away and let them pluck it, pick it, and do what they want with it. I'm called to leave some grapes in my harvest because they fell. That means it's my excess. You know, this is the sort of thing that might go taxes or that we still even have after taxes. I'm required by God to leave it there and go away because God says that belongs to the poor. What we want to do is hold this kind of control. So I say that this is one of two attitudes, I think, that allows us to be hospitable in action, but perhaps not in spirit. Jesus, what do they say about Jesus over and over again? That must be something wrong with him. He sits and he eats with the sinners. He sits and eats covenantal meals. He sits and is hospitable with the sinners. Must be something wrong with that. But you see, Jesus did it in perfect equality. The one of all who might have been walking with a great stride, you know, and a shining head or whatever, I don't know. Doxa, glory. Everyone's going to fall down in front. No. He sits and eats with the sinners. So much so that the righteous ones are just a little bit upset. You follow? Yeah, so anyway, that's one attitude. And I'm speaking prophetically. I know I am. And I don't know who I'm speaking to here, but I do know I'm speaking to congregations in the Lutheran Church. Not all of them, some of them. And to certain attitudes, which I fully understand. I would hold your hands and I would sit by you and I would say, I understand work ethic. I understand how that really became for you success. I would say that. I would not damn it. I would not condemn it. But I would ask you to move one step farther into this community of Christ, which is that you don't, what shall I say, you don't count this wealth a thing to be grasped, but you, how shall I say this, empty yourself. And you take the form of a servant. So, it works. I mean, a lot of people gave us money, but they weren't there. And the second thing, I think, and this is a little more difficult for me to explain, that I think allows hospitality to take place, but nevertheless steals the face of the Spirit of Christ out of it, is when we do it simply because it's the law of God. We do it because we have to. All right, come in. Yeah, well, I have to be down here serving food, and you know, poor guy walking through the line, go. I do, and that's good. It keeps society going. I mean, there is a necessity of the conservative element that we conserve old things and make commandments that our children do what we. But at some point ought to come this recognition that it's not have to, it's wanna. And it's wanna because of my relationship with Jesus. Now I'm touching what I think is this profound motive and the source of my ability to be hospitable. That I myself was taken in. That I myself was forgiven. And I won't argue this. I will just say, for me, this is profoundly important. That I have at some time recognized my sin. Recognized it so clearly that I knew that there was no right for me to be taken in, to be brought home. That I should be, because of my sin, and you know, this is what guilt feels like, I should be the stranger. I should be the world rim walker, the alien, as they said in Beowulf, of that beast Grendel. Grendel was the world rim walker, alien to everything because of the evil that Grendel. Well, I felt that way. I have felt that way. And I can go two ways. In one way, I've often gone, and I think it's wrong, sometimes it is right, it's like, I've gone, I've blamed other people. But other times I said, no, I did it. That's my sin. I did that to them. My children. My church, you all. That's my sin. And then I am alien. That's what guilt feels like. It feels like Cain. And you're not going to kill me because God said don't. So all I got is this mark. God said don't. But you're not going to be hospitable to me. And then you are. And then you are. And I know you shouldn't be, so I look you in the eyes. I say, you're doing this because you have to. No. You're doing it because of Jesus. Or Jesus invites me to the feast. Jesus feeds me, gives me a space. As in our Eucharist. And I realize that this is a true thing. That I have been taken in. I have been turned from the alien and the stranger into the guest. And finally, not just a guest, but a member. I never forget that, people. I know it doesn't obviate my sinning again, but I never forget that there are times that for me were such illumination, when forgiveness was mother's milk, when forgiveness was my being hosted, my being taken in, and I knew before God I should have been. And it was real. That's the main thing. That's why that face of Christ is so important. It was real. And what's the source of that? So that's what I think the attitude is. It really does derive from the gospel. It really does derive from a clear sense of what I have been and what I have been forgiven. And then all that I am, all that I was created for at the beginning, my talents, I'll be very clear about it. No, I'm not going to be this sort of humble guy. No, I can't do it. No. Yeah, I can do those things. I can speak. I can write, sure. But I do it for you. It's the way I become hospitable, you know. I turn those talents back at you. And I can say that quite cheerfully, because that not only do they come from God unto me, but Jesus blessed them. Said, yeah, well, you can do that. Yeah. Clean you up on that score, too. Change your diapers there, too. Let me tell you a story. This is a medieval legend. I didn't make this one up. It is a story of the church. In this story, I hope... And I will end with this, so it'll be a little while. Just relax for my story, just relax. It's about the saint called Julian Hospitator. This is the very first time that the church applied the word hospitator to a saint. It's a true story, but I doubt it happened. But I think it happened. No, what I mean is that there very likely was a Julian, and this is legend that grew up around this fellow, so there was probably bits of something in this legend. But those legends that, I mean, this one probably developed in the 7th or the 8th century in Gaul, France. It was in existence already in Charlemagne, you know, King Charles the Great, Charlemagne's time. So it was very early. Those stories that existed in the church for a long time were true. That's why they existed. They're going to be true not just because they teach doctrine, but because they embrace what people felt, gave shape, meaning, and name to that. It's a hard story. It's a hard one. It comes out of medieval time. My own education, you should know why I know these things. My postgraduate work was in medieval literature. And so I researched some of these things. But I'll just tell it to you as if you're children. Well, at some points, you're going to feel like you need to be an adult to hear this, and maybe it's a bit X-rated. Julian was a child of a lord and lady who owned a large parcel of land. I don't know how they got that land. It was probably granted unto them by some kind of king, for some goodness they did. But they owned it. On that land was their castle. In those days, they were at no war, so they didn't have high walls, but they had forests. And the forests belong altogether to them, and you may know something about that, who gets to hunt that forest and who doesn't get to hunt it. They also had lands, and the people on the lands, the peasants, and so forth and so on, but they were considered to be generous, this lord and lady, and their child, Julian. Had a chapel where they had their priest. We ought to think about that someday. We ought to think about that a lot at Valparaiso, mm-hmm. where the priest belongs to the Duke. Well, maybe not all of us. Had a priest. So they go to worship daily, and Julian go with them. And of course, at worship, it was the family. It was the family. There was just this. It was, and in fact, this was a separate building made out of stone. They'd go to Mass, and they go to worship, and they would be worshiping there. And Julian would sit in the front row, and while everyone else is watching the hoc est corpus, you know, the hoc est corpus, the raising of the body, this is the body, hoc est corpus. Julian, and of course it's in those days that this language began to change into some, well, not those days, it was a little bit later, it's in the early English, that hoc est corpus became?
Hocus.
That's probably how Julian heard it, because he wasn't watching all that stuff. Julian was watching a small hole between the stone wall and the stone floor, the floor of flagstones, right to the left of the chancel, little tiny hole. So all this ritual is going on in front, but Julian, who was about 6 or 7 years old, is always watching there, because he knows at a certain point, probably the hoc est corpus, or the raising of the body point, he's going to see a little pink nose stick out of that hole, because a little pink nose and whiskers. And he waits. Julian shows an aptitude from the time he's 7 years old, only no one is recognizing it, and he doesn't know what he's got. He waits because he has this remarkable hunting patience. He has an aptitude for the hunt. He waits and he watches that little mouse come out, and the mouse comes scurrying over to see if a hook or a corpus has dropped, you know, a little crumb or something. And Julian watches that with dead, cold eyes, and it scurries back again. So that one day Julian comes and he starts saying the words for himself. Nobody else is in there. He's got himself a blunt little dart, one of these things that you would shoot without an arrow from a crossbow. He's got a blunt little dart. And he's sitting in his place he always sits, and he starts saying, hocus, 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 hocus. And the little mouse, thinking, you know, bread, sticks its nose out like that. And it goes its regular track. It goes to the place and finds nothing. And as it's going back, Julian shoots that dart. Bip, hits that mouse on the head, and it dies. So that it bleeds one drop of blood in its pink little nose. And Julian feels excited. You did good. You did good. That was exactly the right time. Micah is one of my best storyteller listeners. Do you like the story so far? It's a bad one, though, Micah. I'm sorry. It's a bad story. Because what we know about Julian, he's got two things. He's got the aptitude. You know, when I watch Michael Jordan play, one of the things I'm most struck with is that there's a place in him that is serene. It doesn't matter how wild that body is, there's a part of him that's making cool decisions. When I get all hot and bothered, my brain is hot and bothered. But these grand sports figures have the capacity to be thinking swiftly and calm, as if there's a gyroscope in there that doesn't move when the body does. And that was Julian. He had this aptitude for the hunt. But he had one other thing. He had one other thing. He also had the blood lust.
Yeah.
The blood lust. So when he grew older, they taught him how to hunt with all the weapons that were in his day. The lance, the spear. He's one of these guys, you know, who could get on the horse and ride that horse bareback just with his legs and take that spear. And as he went by the little, what, you know where hacky sacks are today? Mm-hmm. Well, they made those things out of leather and they hung them from posts. He would, choom, he'd hit that thing right in the center, tear it off. He had the skill. He was especially good with that crossbow, which is a difficult thing, you understand. You have to crank it back. You have to crank it back and drop the dart in and shoot it like that. And it's not as accurate as the longbow was, but he's good at it. Comes the day when he's about 16 years old and the boy goes hunting. The boy goes hunting. The boy becomes a man hunting. He goes into his father's forests, and this day is like mystery. It's like mystery. It's as if the sun itself begins to shine a golden light upon the boy and all the forest. So he doesn't miss anything. Every small creature he sees move, he shoots a dart at it from this crossbow and kills it. And he's beginning to get inside of himself this excitement, almost inexplicable excitement, which we call beside oneself. So there's a part of him that's out of him with that calm mind. Every creature, every ground squirrel, every groundhog, every fox, every coyote, if he was in this country, but he wasn't, he killed. Every bird above him he killed. And the main thing was, he could hit that hawk. That hawk that never flaps its wings, that lays on a shelf of wind. He could hit it right in its throat and bring the thing back. He could hit it where he wanted, in the eye. Moreover, if the geese went over, he could hit one after the other, toom, 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 like that. All day long he went, he had the bloodlust. That's what I mean. It caused in him that sweet sensation that is obscene. And the more he had that sensation, the calmer was his brain. So that he just slaughtered everything until it was evening. And he came upon a valley. The valley, he stood on the edge. It was surrounded by trees, and it was a gloaming. It was like getting dark down there. It was like a large vase in which there was a herd of deer. And he froze at this bounty that was before him and gazed at it, just to pause. And if any deer was looking at him, they might have thought the pause was generosity. It wasn't. It was just anticipation. Suddenly he shot, so that deer after deer went down until he had slaughtered the valley. They slipped in the blood of other deer, and there were finally only three left standing, a fawn and her mother the doe and the stag in a group. And Julian stopped, and all three of them looked back at Julian, all three from the far side of the valley. The mother with pleading in her eyes, but Julian shot the fawn, and it just slumped. And when the mother went up to bugle her sorrow, Julian shot the doe. Down she went. And the stag just looked dead at Julian. Julian, with one last dart, shot that stag right in the center of the forehead, and the dart sank, but the stag did not fall. The stag started walking toward Julian, across the valley. No more darts. Julian stood rooted to the side of the valley. The stag, with a dart here in the forehead, as it were, another antler, began to climb the near side, looking at Julian, and the stag said this. The stag said, "Julian." Now he couldn't move at all. The stag said, "Julian." And when the stag came just almost face to face with his frozen boy, it said, "Just as you killed these animals, so shall you kill your mother and your father." And then it rolled down and died. Well, Julian loved his mother and his father, whatever else. You may have the bloodlust, but there are these good things in you. He loved his mother, and he was scared, and he didn't know what to do. He passed his time doing his best withhold his bloodlust. And this skill, you know, which defined who he was. Only one day, years later, he was walking, about 19, 20 years old, he's walking along the other side of a wall, and he sees the beautiful wings of a swan, the white wings of a swan. And he picks up a stone, just compulsively, he picks up a stone and throws it over the wall, and that swan goes down. He runs to the wall and he looks, and what has happened is his mother was wearing a wimple, and he blew the wimple off her head, but she was unharmed. Oh! And a little while later, he was in the great hall, and his father wanted to get one of his long swords down, hanging on the wall itself. He said, "Julian, will you get it?" And Julian climbed up, and as he reached for the sword, he bumped it, and it went straight down. And it cut the cuirass of his father. And Julian said, "That's it." And because he loved them, he went away from home. He ran away. He didn't tell them where he was going, but he ran away from home. He went to the Saracens. That is to say, the pagans in the minds of these people at that time. And he joined a king. And there his bloodlust and his skill did wonderful things, because this Saracen king was fighting with another. And so for years, Julian worked his way up until he became literally the general, the leader, the governor of all forces. And they won. And by now he's a middle-aged man. And the Saracen king gives him in thanksgiving his daughter, so that Julian marries the daughter of the king and settles down, builds himself his own castle, and receives the land as his father, perhaps. And now he's going to live in contentment the rest of his life. Except, after several years, comes this bloodlust desire. And he can't stand it. One morning he tells his wife he's going hunting. He's going out hunting and to hunt. And he takes the crossbow with him, which has always worked for him, and just a forest of darts. And he goes into the woods and he tries to hit animals, and he can't hit anything. Every time he shoots at the small animal, they run and he misses them, and it just frustrates him. When the animals begin to realize that, he aims and they sit still and he misses them. Hi! He can't stand this. He shoots at the birds and they just wheel and circle above him like they're mocking him, and he can't do it. All day long he misses, until the evening he's missing. Well, while he's gone, just becoming not disappointed, dismayed, and angry, his wife hears a knock at the door, and she opens it up, and there's an elderly couple. Woman has iron gray hair, long and straight, down to her waist, and the man has a strong beard. Does Julian live here, they say? And she says, yes. And they say, well, we are his parents. We've lost our land, and we've been seeking him for over these 2 years. Come in, she says. Oh, he'll be so glad to see you. Come in. And she becomes the host. Come, and then she says, he's out hunting. He'll be home soon. Well, as they're waiting, she feeds them, and they're tired. She puts them to bed. She gives them her bed, their bed. And she waits downstairs for her husband to come home. But she falls asleep. When Julian comes home, he opens up the door, and he's seething with the loss of his identity, that he cannot fulfill these things, skill or bloodlust, either one. He's seething. And he goes straight up to his bedroom, and he goes into the bedroom to tell his wife what went on. And there he feels, in the darkness, her long hair. But when he's about to wake her and talk to her, he hears a snore on the other side, and he goes to the other side, and he feels a beard. And all this disappointment rises up in him at this point, and without a thought, he draws a dagger, and he kills both of the people in the bed. And behind him, the light comes on, and it's his wife, and she's holding a lantern, and he looks. He thought sheep. And he sees his parents. Now he is the alien. Now he is overwhelmed with his guilt. He tells his wife that he's running away the second time and forever, and please don't follow him. Please do not follow him. He becomes the world rim walker. He does not go near cities. He has no right to the joy of the cities, to the laughter, to the beer they drink. He has no right to anything. He just walks by himself, barely living years. Until finally, because of his sense of this horrible guilt, bloodlust is gone from him right now, but not the consequence. And he had been told, you know, almost like Jesus told Peter, here, I'll give you the sign. You're going to deny me, and the crow is going to be the sign to make you know. The deer gave him a sign. He knew. He knew. He said he should kill himself. He had no right to live. So he found a very deep pond. And he stood on the edge of the pond and prepared to jump in. He held in both hands weights like rocks, rocks like weights. And as he leaned over to jump in, he saw reflected in the pool his father's face. And he couldn't do it. He couldn't kill his father the second time. It was his face. It was his beard, but it was his father's. And so he's denied all things. He's denied even death. This is what he does. He finds by a broad river where there is no bridge and no way to cross, a small boat, a painter boat. He fixes it up and he gives himself to any who would come by. He chooses to become the one who rows them across the river no matter what time of day, no matter how bad the weather. He becomes the hospitator. Julian is all they had to say. Julian, no matter where they were. And he'd come out of his small hut and he would put them in the boat and take them across. He did that for years. He got to be known. All the people came here, and he did it. He did it. One day, one night, when the weather was just atrocious, when the weather was wild and the wind was high, and the river itself clapped hands, when the waves of the river rose up and clapped hands with the wildness of the darkness of the storm, Julian in his hut heard this outside. He heard this. Julian! Julian, it was so far away he couldn't be quite sure, but it was a sound he'd heard before. He went out, and in the wind, which tore at his beard and his hair, he looked across, and in the darkness, in the flash of the lightning, he saw a figure on the far side of the river. But he was hospitator. Dangerous as it was, he put his boat in, and he rowed to the other side, fighting the waves and the current. And there stood on the other side, straight up and down, a gaunt-looking figure, with rags blowing in the wind. Take me to the other side, said the figure. And Julian nodded, and the figure stepped in the back of his boat, and that boat nearly sank with the weight of this individual. Julian rose up and fought. The individual never sat down, just stood in the back of that boat. And Julian fought the wind and fought the current and fought the waves to get to the other side, nearly expiring himself. When he got to the other side, the figure walked forward and got out and didn't go anywhere. Looked straight at Julian, and Julian saw in the little light and the flashes of lightning that this was leper. That the skin had been chewed away, that the ears were nearly gone. Gaunt, red-rimmed eyes. And the figure said, Julian. He'd heard that before. Said, Julian, I'm cold.
let me in your hut.
And Julian invited him into that space, into that room in his hut, which was low, and there was just a small fire going.
I'm hungry, Julian, said the figure.
Julian had had a little loaf of bread. It was the last bread he had, and he was going to eat it. But he gave it to the one. And when that leper ate that bread, Julian thought he smelled meat.
Julian, said the other one, I'm thirsty.
Julian had but a little water left. And he gave it all to that figure who drank it. And when he drank it, Julian thought he smelled wine. But the leper, who is now simply oozing on his face, says, Julian, I am so tired. Let me lie, which is just a pallet. Julian allowed it, and the leper lay on his back, stretched straight out, almost like he was a figure on a sarcophagus. Bony legs.
Julian said, I am so cold. Warm me.
So Julian stretched his body. Julian, of no value, stretched his body. Elbow for elbow, wrist for wrist, face to face, hip and knee to hip and knee, on that figure to warm him. And the figure felt at first like ice. It just sucked the heat right out of Julian's body. And then the figure put his arms around Julian's chest and began to squeeze, as if he would force the breath out. And this figure was strong, so strong that Julian opened up his eyes, and he saw the eyes of the stranger staring right into his eyes, face to face and eye to eye. And his own eyes, the stranger's eyes, were beginning to take a brown flashing, like brown shots of lightning. And all of a sudden, that figure's hair shot up, as if it were electric, shot out around his head and began to glow like a burning fire. And Julian realized that the figure was rising up, holding Julian around his chest, rising and rising so high that they split through the roof of the hut and rose higher and higher in the air, so that this is the way that our dear Lord Jesus Christ took Julian Hospitator home again forever.